Welcome back to On the Case, the podcast. I'm Paula Zahn, and thanks for joining us for episode 31, Buried Dreams. Tonight, we're on the case in El Paso, Texas, along the border between the United States and Mexico. This peaceful desert community was the backdrop for a disturbing mystery. After 15-year-old Desiree Wheatley vanished without a trace. As the teenager's mother, Marcia, began her desperate quest to find Desiree, she never could have imagined the terrifying string of crime she would help police discover. June 2nd, 1987. It was close to 2 a.m. when Marcia Fulton returned home from her swing shift at a nearby factory. She was surprised when her mother, who had been babysitting Marcia's two teenage daughters, met her at the front door.
She was highly upset, very upset. I said, "What's wrong?" She goes, "Desi's not home yet."
Desiree, known as Desi, was Marcia's 15-year-old daughter.
I said, "When was she supposed to be home?" And she goes, "Well, I told her she could come in at 10.
The teenager's grandmother explained that Desiree had been celebrating the last day of school at a friend's house, and she had called to ask for an extension of her 8 p.m. curfew.
So my mother said, "Okay, but be home at 10.
Desiree's grandmother said she knew she had a problem. When Desiree's older sister, Sunday, arrived home from her end-of-school party, but there was still no sign of Desiree.
Mom said, "Is Desi with you?" And she goes, "No, I didn't know she was supposed to be."
Sunday said she hadn't seen or heard from her all that night, which was unusual.
So they started calling around to different friends because they both pretty much had the same set of friends.
Sunday quickly discovered that Desiree had left her friend's house with another girl to make the short walk home around 9:30 that night. It was a safe neighborhood, one where Desiree had walked home at night many times before without an incident. In fact, Marcia had always been comfortable with her daughter coming home on foot, even in the dark.
Never had any reason not to. There wasn't anything going on. It was just a regular neighborhood. It was Main Street. So, no, I had no qualms about that.
Desiree's friend said they had stopped at a Circle K around 9:45. The convenience store was just a few blocks from Marcia's home.
They divided up after they got out of the Circle K. Desi went to the left, she went to the right, and they were kind of like backing up, talking to each other as they were walking down the street.
Neither Sunday nor her grandmother spoke with anyone who had seen Desiree after she left the Circle K. As Marcia listened to the details of the story, she knew it was time to call the police. Detective John Guerrero.
She reported her daughter as missing, and she was adamant that she had not left or gone voluntarily.
Marcia told officers that her daughter had last been seen just steps from home and would have been on time unless something terrible had happened along the way. Police listened to the distraught mother, and they agreed that Desiree wouldn't have called to extend her curfew if she had plans to run away.
She had called her grandmother, and she asked for permission, which a lot of kids don't do.
But still, El Paso police officers didn't think that Desiree was in any real trouble. End of school celebrations had kept them busy all night, and they assured Marcia that Desiree would turn up soon.
They kept saying, "Look, all these kids, last day of school, you know, we're having so many calls about kids missing. We'll find her."
The officers filled out the missing persons report, but Marcia was upset that they weren't taking the possibility of foul play seriously. She felt that police had dismissed the idea that something was terribly wrong.
I was angry. I didn't feel like they had.
Looking back, the police admit that they might not have taken the original report as seriously as they should have. At the time, El Paso was considered to be one of the safest places to live in Texas, and it wasn't unusual for teenagers to stay out past their curfews even late into the night.
9 out of 10 times, we find them at a friend's house. Everybody thought, she'll be home sooner or later. When you're the mother and it's your child that's missing, that's probably not what you want to hear.
While police put out an all-points bulletin, Marcia got into her car and began her own search.
I just needed to feel I had to do something. I could not just sit there. I think it was just something to keep me from jumping out of my skin.
She knew that Desiree had been wearing shorts, sneakers, and an oversized white T-shirt that she wanted her classmates to sign. Instead of being consumed with fear, Marcia hit the streets. She drove through every corner of the neighborhood and spoke with as many people as she could, determined to find her daughter.
Something just said, just keep going. You'll find something.
The whole time, Marcia kept replaying the last conversation she had had with her daughter. When she had dropped Desiree off for her last day of eighth grade,
she starts to walk away, and she turns around. She waves goodbye. She goes, "Bye, Mom. Thanks a lot." She goes, "Love you." I said, "Love you, too. See you tonight."
But while that tender memory filled her heart, it couldn't keep Marcia from the terrifying reality that Desiree was in trouble, and there was nothing she could do to help her.
I don't know if you've ever heard this feeling that somebody just walked over your grave is what I got. And I knew right then and there, I would never see her alive. I just knew it.
Marcia's maternal instinct about her daughter was one that had been tested many times before. After all, no one knew 15-year-old Desiree Wheatley better than the single mother who raised her. The two shared a very special bond.
We were very close. They had wrote a paper that year at her school that, you know, if you were lost on a deserted island, who would you want to be with? A lot of the kids wrote, well, Bon Jovi. And then she says, I would like to be with my mom.
Although Marcia had a busy and difficult work schedule, she always knew what was going on in Desiree's life. And that wasn't always easy because Desiree was in constant motion.
She was active, always on. As soon as she stopped moving that night, she'd be asleep. Two speeds, fast and sleep.
Desiree was popular at school and was a good student.
Just smiling, just happy all the time. Friends liked her because she was honest. She was very open. She was definitely a free spirit, and she was caring. She'd give you the shirt off her back and not expect anything in return for it.
As the hours turned into days following Desiree's disappearance, Marcia was desperate for answers. But she had no idea how to get them.
There was no handbook. What do you do next? How do you get any help when they won't listen to you?
Marcia's main strategy was persistence.
I had this mantra, she's not a runaway, she's not a runaway. I would literally walk in and ask to see a district attorney. No one wanted to deal with me. They really didn't.
She was angry. I don't blame her. She said my daughter would have called me, she would have gotten in touch with me. Something has happened to my daughter. She went to city council, she was going to the higher-ups in the police department. She was raising hell about her daughter. She was just as tenacious as possible.
Marcia's presence was a powerful reminder that no progress had been made in the case of her missing daughter. It was something she continued to impress upon the investigators.
We're not getting anywhere. Nothing's happening.
Marcia refused to simply wait for law enforcement. She posted flyers around El Paso, reached out to the local Crime Stoppers to offer a reward for any information that might lead to answers. Investigators were in awe of Marcia's strength and endurance. They knew that she would not stop until she found out what had happened to her daughter.
A pit bull. From the very beginning, something has happened to my daughter. She's missing. She would not be gone this long. I want answers. I want you to find my daughter.
Then, 3 days after Desiree's disappearance, a story in the local newspaper caught Marcia's attention. A 20-year-old woman had gone missing in northeast El Paso, the same area as Desiree. Her name was Karen Baker.
So after I got in touch with Mary Baker, we started talking. Desi was missing, Karen was missing. Where are our daughters?
Soon, the two mothers learned that another teenage girl, 14-year-old Marjorie Knox, had gone missing in February. She had been in the same five-block radius as the other girls on the night she disappeared. Marcia couldn't help but think that the cases were somehow connected.
They were all about the same age, same body shape, and from the same area.
Marjorie Knox had attended a party in El Paso, close to where Desiree had last been seen. Marjorie's sister, Cheryl Price.
Marjorie and her friend got a ride to El Paso to attend a party near Veterans Park.
Veterans Park was a popular hangout for teenagers. Marjorie Knox had been seen there the night she went missing. But Marjorie never made it home.
My parents were extremely concerned that she wasn't home, but they were under the impression that she was just staying at her friend's house.
But the next morning, it became clear something far more sinister had happened.
It was just awful.
As the parents of the three girls discussed their cases, they became convinced that there was only one logical explanation. Their daughters had been abducted, possibly by the same serial predator.
I told him, I said, look, it's just too much coincidence for all these girls to be missing from virtually the same spot in El Paso. I just know in my gut as a mother they are related.
On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment. Marcia was stunned that three young women could just disappear without a trace. And she was determined to prove to the police that Desiree's case was a part of something much more sinister going on in the El Paso area. And Marcia wasn't the only one that believed a serial killer was on the loose and using El Paso as his hunting ground. Detective John Guerrero.
Several of the parents got in touch with Marcia because Marcia was putting her phone number out. She had flyers. She had all kinds of stuff on her daughter.
Frustrated with the lack of progress the police had made, Marcia and the families of the other missing girls decided to stage a protest in the middle of the city to draw media attention to their cause. Desiree's mother, Marcia Fulton.
I wanted to push the issue into the forefront.
The El Paso Times covered the event. Reporter Diana Washington Valdez.
To have the mothers of missing daughters trying to call attention to their plight, we've never seen anything like that in El Paso, Texas.
The shocking story sparked outrage across the community.
mayor starting calling a police chief rounding up his troops saying, hey, what's going on here?
The family's plan had worked. Following the demonstration, the El Paso Police Department was flooded with calls, and the names of some previously unreported missing girls were added to the list. As the numbers continued to escalate, investigators were forced to listen to what Marcia Fulton had been saying for weeks.
Once we realized that we had 9 girls missing, all approximately the same age, all in this 2 to 3 mile radius, we got on it right away.
After the police began connecting the dots between the cases, they quickly realized that El Paso was in far greater trouble than they ever could have imagined.
You don't have 9 girls just mysteriously disappear and there's not something going on. There's got to be a common denominator someplace. But where were they? We couldn't find them. We didn't know anything about them. We were in some serious trouble.
Then, detectives got a tip that turned their troubling theories into an official homicide investigation.
The El Paso Police Department received a call from a utility worker who thought he had found the remains of a human body buried in the desert.
Detective Gerardo Ibarra.
He was a water utilities worker because there's whales out there in that part of the desert area. As he's walking by, he could see a human leg protruding out of the sand.
Investigators were forced to wonder if their darkest suspicions regarding the missing women had just been uncovered. When police arrived at the location, they sealed off the area. Their initial search confirmed the utility worker's worst fears. He had stumbled upon the decaying body of a young woman. The gruesome scene shocked even hardened homicide detectives.
Death has an odor that you'll never forget. It's something that just sticks with you for the rest of your life.
As detectives began processing the area for clues, they made another horrifying discovery just a few yards away. A second body.
We were not expecting that at all.
We're all human beings. Almost everybody in that division has children. So you find a little girl that's been brutally murdered, buried like a piece of trash in the desert, and you can't help but think, oh my God, what if this was my child?
The bodies were found just beneath the surface of the sand. Their shallow grave suggested to investigators that the suspect had to leave the area in a hurry.
Obviously, there was an attempt to conceal the bodies. The problem was that he just didn't bury them deep enough. And because of the wildlife that is in that area, the animals dug around the bodies, and that's what exposed one of the bodies.
Law enforcement focused on finding evidence that might put them on the trail of a vicious killer. Both victims had been buried face down and were partially clothed. Based on the vast differences in the condition of the bodies, investigators theorized the young women had been killed many weeks apart. But there was no doubt in detectives' minds that the two victims were killed by the same person.
Police officers don't believe in coincidences. What are the chances that two girls are going to be buried yards apart from each other and that the same person didn't do it? None whatsoever.
The profile of the victims were the same as far as size, the stature, and petite. And they were both buried face down, partially clothed. We knew that whoever committed this, it was the same person.
Detectives weren't able to identify the bodies at the scene, But the medical examiner ultimately confirmed that the victims had been 20-year-old Karen Baker and 24-year-old Maria Cassio. Autopsies showed that Maria had died from asphyxiation, but the cause of Karen's death was undetermined due to the condition of her body. Maria had only been missing a couple of weeks, while Karen had disappeared around the same time as Desiree Wheatley. Investigators found only one connection between the two victims. They had both last been seen in North El Paso, just blocks from where Desiree had disappeared. That clue led investigators to a terrifying conclusion.
We have a serial killer on our hands.
And that meant that it was just a matter of time before detectives found more bodies buried in the desert. As the horrific news spread about the discovery of the bodies of young women buried in the desert, residents and police in El Paso were stunned.
El Paso had never had a crime of that magnitude. El Paso is known as the safest city in Texas. Not only were we shocked and surprised, the public also was in fear.
You can imagine how all the parents must be thinking. Two girls have been found in the desert. What's happened to them?
Marsha Fulton didn't have to read the papers or watch TV to get those answers. She heard about the tragedy firsthand from the family of one of the victims.
Mary Baker called me, crying. She goes, they found two bodies. She asked me first, had the police called me? And I said, no. She goes, okay, that's probably good, because they called me and told me they found Karen's body.
Marsha grieved for the Baker family and herself. In her heart, she knew that her daughter Desiree was most likely buried in that desert. She picked up the phone and called El Paso police, demanding answers.
I said, okay, they found two bodies. Now what are you going to do? And they said, we have a detective assigned to your case. He's going to come out and talk to you.
Investigators told Marsha that although Desiree was not one of the young women they had found, they feared that she had been the victim of the same killer. But this time around, investigators assured her that they were going to do everything they could to find Desiree.
He said, well, we're going to start all over. We're going to start from the beginning, from scratch. You know, he had me go over the whole scenario, what happened the day she disappeared and all that.
El Paso police had to face a grim reality. Marsha Fulton had been right all along. There was a deadly predator on the loose.
We knew we had a serious problem here, and we were put on the case 24/7 to investigate it. We were getting a lot of pressure to solve the case.
In response to the public outcry, the El Paso police created a special task force dedicated to finding the missing girls. They desperately called upon other agencies for help.
We brought in Border Patrol, National Guard, DPS, El Paso Police, and canine units. We brought cadaver sniffing dogs.
Search teams fanned out from the spot where the first two bodies had been found.
We probably had a good 100 out there that day, if not more, shoulder to shoulder, walking the desert. Very somber, very resolute. Everybody knew that we were undertaking a very gruesome assignment.
And there was a vast amount of desert to cover.
We were all arm's length away, just like in the military. And we're given these huge prods. We're walking and we're prodding, hitting the dirt, pulling it out.
the exhaustive effort failed to reveal any additional evidence.
We found dead rabbits, dead coyotes, that kind of stuff. But nothing. Nothing.
But the media coverage of the search did generate a critical new tip. One that would change the course of the investigation. A woman came forward to report that she had been abducted and sexually assaulted in the same stretch of desert where the bodies were found. Her name was Judy.
She told us that she was picked up by a guy, an Anglo guy, mid-20s, in a light-colored truck.
Judy said the man she had met outside a convenience store offered her a ride, and she accepted. Almost immediately, the man threatened her with a knife and drove out into the desert. Judy was still visibly shaken as she relayed to detectives how the attack unfolded.
When they get to this location, the guy, he tied her up. But then it becomes very clear to her that she is going to be raped.
Judy said her attacker dragged her out of the truck and placed her on a small orange blanket he had in the truck.
He brutally raped her, and then he hears something. There's another vehicle that's in the area, and he panics.
The young woman told officers her attacker then jumped back into his truck and fled, leaving her tied up and naked in the desert.
She unties herself and she takes off and she runs. Then she gets out to the road and it was a truck driver that picked her up.
Judy told police that when she heard about the bodies in the desert, she was certain that they had been the victims of the same vicious predator.
She tells him, "I can find the place."
Judy offered to show Detective Guerrero the location where she had been assaulted, an area known to locals as Telephone Pole Road.
"Show it to me. Get in my car and take us right now." She jumps in the backseat of the car. She's describing the same area, the telephone poles and all that. She keeps going. "Turn to the right. Turn to the right. Drive a little bit further. Stop here."
Guerrero was stunned.
"Oh my God, it's in the same place where the two girls were found."
It was then that Judy realized just how lucky she had been to survive. And Detective Guerrero knew that the information the brave victim had just provided could break the case wide open.
"Judy places him at the crime scene. He took her there. He raped her there. He was probably going to kill her."
Not only had Judy taken him to the site of the crime, she was able to give police their first clues about the suspect. He was a scruffy-looking white male in his 20s. She also provided detectives with a solid description of his light-colored truck. But perhaps the most important detail she provided was the nickname of her attacker. He had introduced himself as Skeeter. Investigators could only hope the young woman's story might lead them to a suspect and stop a serial killer before he struck again. More on The Case, the podcast, after this. Neither of the victims discovered in the desert had been 15-year-old Desiree Wheatley, but her mother felt it was only a matter of time until she received the news she had been dreading for months.
Every time the phone would ring, someone knock on the door, I'm like peeling me off the ceiling, you know, because you're waiting for that other shoe to drop, and there's nothing you can do about it.
It now appeared certain that the months of hard work Marcia had done to bring attention to Desiree's case would end in tragedy. It was an outcome she prepared for from the beginning. Detective John Guerrero.
From day one, the best way I can describe it, they just had a very good mother-daughter relationship. She kept telling us, "You don't know my daughter, I do." She knew that something bad had happened to her daughter. Unfortunately, she was right.
The brave survivor of a sexual assault had led investigators to the location of her attack. And when detectives searched the area, it confirmed everyone's worst fears.
The police department searched a 3-mile radius in the desert, and one of our canine units discovered another body.
Officer Romero Gonzalez will never forget that shocking moment.
A small breeze, just as you see right now, is occurring. My dog's head came up, caught a whiff of scent of something. He located a small rabbit hole. He started excavating the hole, and it was human remains.
Then, just 15 yards away, an officer made another gruesome find.
He says, "I think I've got another one." And so, sure enough, we start digging, and we're getting further and further down. We're probably down about 2.5-3 feet. And then we see a leg.
It took investigators the better part of the day to uncover the second body. Police were confident the same killer was responsible for both victims. Detective Gerardo Ibarra.
That was an eerie feeling for me because I investigated a lot of murders, but never been to an actual crime scene where it's human skeletal remains. I had never witnessed nothing like that.
As they processed the two shallow graves, detectives found important evidence.
We were able to identify personal items and clothing and jewelry and orange fibers.
The orange fibers did not match any of the other items police had found. Experts believe they could have been transferred from the orange blanket Judy had described.
The famous orange blanket. That links the people together.
The medical examiner ultimately needed medical records to identify the victims. Detective Guerrero was heartbroken when he was told one of the victims had been Desiree Wheatley. He immediately picked up the phone to make the most difficult call of his career. He had to break the tragic news to Marcia Fulton.
I just told her, I said, "I think we found Desiree and you need to come down."
At the morgue, Marcia was asked to look at the victim's clothing. Among the items, the tattered, oversized white t-shirt Desiree had worn on her last day of school. It had been stained red by the desert sand.
There was the t-shirt with the names written all over it for classmates.
And so, of course, that was a clear giveaway. I can only imagine what that must have been like.
After Marshall saw Desiree's t-shirt, she was forced to accept that her loving daughter would never be coming home.
It was almost numbing. Sometimes you ask yourself, was it better not to know, or was it better to know? It was better to know for me. I didn't have to sit there for the rest of my life waiting for an answer.
As El Paso police watched the devoted mother trying to come to terms with the loss of her child, the investigators struggled with their own emotions.
I hurt for her now. I hurt it for her then. I hurt for her daughter that never got to grow up, never got to get married, and graduated from high school.
At Desiree's funeral, Marcia Fulton steeled herself for the next stage of her mission. She made a vow to her deceased daughter that day, and she aimed to keep her promise.
At the gravesite, I kissed her coffin, and I told her. I said, I will find out who did this, and justice will be served for them. This is my baby. No one's going to kill her and just get away with it.
El Paso police were equally committed to that goal, and that meant following up on the leads that had been provided by Judy, the brave survivor of a vicious assault. Detectives theorized their suspect had been stalking teenage hangouts and parties looking for his young female victims. They spoke with area high school students to see if they knew anyone who matched the description of Judy's attacker.
We started talking to the kids. Have you guys ever seen Bates truck with this Anglo guy? And the kids, oh yeah, man, that's that guy, you know, he's weird, man. And his name is Skeeter.
Skeeter was the nickname Judy had told to police. The kids knew him as a harmless yet odd guy who hung around the area and offered to buy them alcohol.
They obviously thought that there was something wrong with the guy. But, you know, he's buying booze, he's giving them cigarettes. He's the Pied Piper, man.
As investigators dug deeper, they discovered that Skeeter's real name was David Leonard Wood. He was a 30-year-old sex offender who had been released from prison just 5 months before Desiree disappeared. Police brought Judy in to view a photo lineup.
We lay out a photographic array, 6 pictures to Judy. Do you see the person that raped you in this lineup? That's him right there. No hesitation. We're fairly certain we've got the right guy.
Wood's family lived just a few blocks from a park that was a gathering spot for teens.
We're running photographic lineups to all the kids. They all identify him.
Reporter Diana Washington Valdez remembers the outrage around El Paso when residents discovered that a known sex offender had been secretly living among them.
He was what we consider today a classic sexual predator. It really surprised me that someone with that kind of background could have just been released into the neighborhood.
Valdez found out that while the local kids thought Wood was somewhat sketchy, he had an uncanny ability to appear totally non-threatening.
People felt, well, yes, he's strange, he's creepy, he's odd, but that's all. And I think the young people who would have notices may have discussed it among themselves, but they weren't telling the grown-ups, they weren't telling the parents.
Police arrested Wood for his sexual assault of Judy and continued to build a case against him for the 4 unsolved murders. A search warrant was executed on his home and truck, but it appeared authorities were already too late. Wood had been covering his tracks.
When we opened the truck and started doing the search, you could still feel where he had been cleaning his truck, washing everything out of the inside and outside of the truck. We got rid of a lot of evidence.
But detectives did find evidence of Wood's obsession with young girls in his bedroom.
We opened drawers, and we find hundreds and hundreds of pictures of little girls.
And then investigators got creative. Knowing that Wood had recently cleaned the interior of his truck, they seized the contents of a vacuum cleaner. In the vacuum bag, they recovered orange fibers. Testing revealed they were a match to the fibers found with the bodies in the desert.
we were able to recover fibers that were found in the grave site.
Those arch fibers were the exact same arch fibers they found on Desi.
Although it was never recovered, police suspected the fibers had come from the orange blanket Judy described. After Wood's arrest, a customer at a Circle K came forward with more damning evidence. He positively identified David Wood as having been in the store on the night Desiree disappeared.
I believe that's the way it happened. Just as the kids were coming in, he's walking out of the store.
Detectives believe that Wood had seen the teenager and waited to abduct her after she left the store.
Here's what I think happened. He's walking out the store and he sees these kids come in. He gets in his truck and goes around and he waits. One kid went to the right. Unfortunately, Desiree went to the left. And guess who's waiting? Right by the store, but Skeeter, a.k.a. David Leonard Wood.
Police believe that Wood followed the same M.O. he had used during his attack on Judy. He drove Desiree into the desert, sexually assaulted her, and then murdered her. In the end, a total of 6 bodies were recovered in that same area. Detectives found witnesses who connected each of the victims to Wood. Still, he never confessed to the crimes.
Never admitted. Never talked. Never said a word.
And while Wood normally portrayed a cool facade, some of those on the case witnessed a whole other side of his personality.
He loses his temper very quickly. He's a very scary, evil individual to the point where he even kind of scared me.
In July of 1990, David Wood was charged with 6 counts of first-degree murder, including the murder of Desiree Wheatley. Marcia attended every day of his trial. When his guilty verdict was read, she was overcome with relief.
It was almost like, hey, we got this going, you know. I'm almost there, baby. Almost there.
But Marcia knew she wouldn't fulfill her promise to Desiree until she was sure that David Wood could never hurt another soul.
He will not do this again. Will not do this again.
And it appeared that wish was granted when Wood was sentenced to death for his horrific crime spree. He also received an additional 50-year sentence for the kidnapping and sexual assault of Judy. Police believe Wood is also responsible for 3 other missing girls, including 14-year-old Marjorie Knox. Her family remains in painful limbo, not certain of her fate. Marjorie's sister, Cheryl Price.
It's a lot to deal with. It's wondering every day. I have to block some of it off because you will not survive if you do not.
In August of 2009, 24 hours before Wood was scheduled to be executed, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals issued a stay of execution. Marcia was outraged.
My heart sunk, you know, because it's almost over. And then it was just ripped away from you.
Wood's final appeal was denied, but he remains on death row. Marcia hopes she will be there when he finally pays for his crimes. Still, her greatest fear is that she might not live long enough to see that day.
I'm praying to God that he goes first.
Marcia believes witnessing Wood's death will mean that she kept her promise to Desiree.
Marcia Wheatley is committed to seeing justice accomplished for her daughter. She made a vow to her daughter, and Marcia is living now to see that justice carried out.
John Guerrero hopes that Marsha gets the peace she deserves.
She has the utmost respect from me, from anybody that worked that horrendous crime.
After Desiree's death, Marsha spent 5 years volunteering at the police department as part of their crisis response team.
I was one of the first members to help crime victims at the scene of the crime. It was helpful to the other people that I did help, and it helped me. It was cathartic. I couldn't help Desi anymore, but maybe I could help someone else.
There are times when Marsha reflects on her long, lonely quest to get answers for her daughter. And she used to ask herself how she summoned the strength to keep fighting for justice. For her, the answer has become crystal clear.
I asked myself, how did you do that for so many years? You know, and then not give up. And I thought, shoot, there's no giving up. You don't give up on Desi. You just don't. Basically, it was love.
During Marsha Fulton's victim's impact statement, the judge allowed David Wood to leave the courtroom. Marsha was so outraged that she helped get a law passed in Texas that mandates that felons must be present when a family member gives a victim's impact statement. David Wood, also known as the Desert Killer, has been on death row longer than any inmate in Texas. After decades of appeals, on March 11th, 2025, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals granted a stay of execution for David Wood just 2 days before he was scheduled to be put to death. It was the second time that Wood's execution had been halted. Then, on July 31st, 2025, the same court sent his capital murder case back to a trial court to re-examine the case. Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to follow, rate, and review. And if you want more information on today's case, visit facebook.com/paulazanofficial or just click the link in the episode description. I'm Paula Zahn. Please join us again next Wednesday when we're back on the case, the podcast.